Welcome, Outposters. Well, I've got a very special treat for you here today. I've got acclaimed Australian film director Brian Trenchard-Smith, and he is probably most known in the States for the Leprechaun, two of the Leprechaun sequels. However, I think what I found, and I'm going to kind of give you my, I feel like I rediscovered you. I saw what they called in the United States The Quest, but you had titled it Frog Dreams.
Frog Dreaming,
thank you.
Relating to Aboriginal dream time, this was the Frog Dreaming.
I saw it when I was about that. I'm about Henry Thomas's age, you know, so when he did E.T., I was watching a lot of stuff that he was in. And I remember seeing this, and I don't think I'd seen it since. And so when we got together, I said, well, I want to go back. And I looked, and I found that movie on Prime, and I rewatched it again. And I was like, I felt like I stepped back in time. I was like, I remember this, and I love this movie, and how could I forget about this movie? And I feel like it's kind of gone into the mists of time, and I'm going to be on a mission to bring it back.
Well, thank you very much. It is, in its way, a timeless children's film, or a family film, really, though some aspects of it would be considered to be politically incorrect now.
Kids smoking?
In a Disney movie, you would not have a 10-year-old asking her mother, can you get herpes from French kissing?
No, you wouldn't.
Things like that. So, or you wouldn't have a 10-year-old smoking.
Nope.
But the writer, Everett DeRoche, who is probably Australia's greatest genre writer of the Australian film industry renaissance of the 70s, he had six children, and he knew the language and the thinking of, you know, of kids, and he put it into those characters when he created them. So I liked that insight and those various aspects of that were politically incorrect. Because that's the way kids are, really. So it was, it was a fun film to do, and I really liked the kids I worked with.
Well, it definitely was for kids my age, because we were doing things like that, building tree houses or running around. Your parents just said, get out of here in the summers. Don't come back until dinner time, because they just wanted to be left alone, which just gave you an insane amount of freedom to explore and maybe, get hurt and that sort of thing. I'm not saying they were irresponsible, but you really, I felt like just watching it again, it's like, wow, I'd forgotten how much I miss being that age and when everybody wasn't a helicopter parent.
Yes, I know. And then, of course, I became a parent. And I was a parent when I was making Frog Dreaming and BMX Bandits, my two best children's films. And both of them, try to reflect the joy of being a kid, where you could just go out and do stuff in the afternoon, take your bike and just go off and do stuff, explore, have adventures, etc. And both films reflect that in their different ways. So now, they're obviously helicopter parents, and of course, the terrible social media drug that kids are addicted to, the iPhone. And the computer, which I spend far too many hours of the day on. So kids are not able to be the kids that my generation once was, and certainly my parents' generation. My father, for instance, taught his mother to drive when he was 12. That was in Auckland, New Zealand, where the family had moved after living in Sydney. It was, business took his father to Auckland, in a nice, pleasant suburb of Auckland at that time. There were cars available. It was 1922, and there was really no problem about a tall 12-year-old you know, on a property, driving the car and driving around local roads, and he taught his mother to drive. So times have changed now.
But yeah, I don't know if it's for the better or for the worse. I do think that kids' movies today are way too sanitized. Do you think that there's any chance you could have made that today in this climate?
Well, I certainly think that there are key lines in the film and key moments that would have not got through your basic studio development executive. Oh no, you can't have that. You can't have a 10-year-old reading a book before she goes to sleep called The Perfumed Garden. Just a little grace note. You just see that this precocious 10-year-old, the one who with the question to her mother, she'd obviously somehow picked up a copy of The Perfumed Garden and was staring at it wide-eyed. So the little thing that I threw in that I don't know whether when the film played on the Disney Channel, whether they cut that out or whether they cut all these offensive lines and her smoking out. I mean, that's the sort of thing they would do. But no, undoubtedly, those aspects of it would have been sanitized. And there would be suddenly great concern about kids imitating Henry Thomas, putting on a diving, a goldfish bowl as a diving helmet and going underwater with a homemade air pipe, and look what happened, we could get sued because people will be imitating, kids will imitate the movie, and so it's let's say freedom of speech has its restrictions, let's say, in the development process of let's say family movies, and that's what is considered to be politically correct at the time. Anyway, I talk about this in my book.
Bring it out.
I've actually, maybe your viewers are aware of Adventures in the B Movie Trade, which I wrote last year and put it out before Christmas. Because I thought it would be useful to those wanting to enter the film business to see, what a nearly 60-year career in the business, I'm still dabbling. What that career path was like, albeit the circumstances that I was fortunate enough to enjoy. Breaking in and establishing myself in the business in Australia, and then starting again in America in 1990. That might be instructive to film students and those sort of at the ground floor of the business, because I tried to go through the things I did right and all the things that I did wrong, and maybe there's a lesson to be learned for people. But primarily, it's a book that says if you really want something badly enough, if you try hard enough, then you can get there. Persistence is everything. So that's my advice to anyone who reads the book. But I've tried to write it with a degree of humor so that you'll have a few laughs. Certainly, I've had my share of hair-raising moments on 300-foot cliffs, or being set on fire, or being hit by a car a couple of times, deliberately. But I've had many more hilarious moments which I have described in the book, working with lions and chimpanzees and, working with development executives and the like. So there are many, tales from the trenches of the movie business to be found in my book. So I would suggest to your listeners that if you find my talk remotely interesting, go get the Kindle for $9.99 or the book for $20, and it's 580 pages, 200 pages of pictures. So you will not be bored.
Well, those of you watching, make sure you look in the description. The link is there to pick up Brian's book. And I'm probably going to pick it up myself now that I know about it. I feel like the B movie trade is more the free movie trade, so to speak. Like if you're making a $300 million Avengers movie, you've got thousands of people, you know, keeping you in a box on where you can go and where you can't go because it's a lot of money. When you make something the Quest, or you know, you put a giant crane in a pond, and you made it look scary during the day because you don't have hundreds of CGI artists working. You just had to do it, and I find there's a lot of creativity that you just don't have in these computerized, sanitized movies these days.
No, I mean, while you know, I mean, there's. There's never enough money, never enough time, says James Cameron, with $300 million. There is never, you know, there's still more you would like to do to perfect the work. But eventually, he said, films are not finished, they're abandoned. So that's at the upper end of the scale, and it's still not enough. Down at the bottom end of the scale, when I made my very first 50-minute, 16-millimeter color documentary called The Stuntmen, about how stuntmen do their stunts, and it's an area I've returned to a number of times, both in fiction and in documentary. I knew that I had to make that 16 grand that I was able to borrow really count, so you had to be inventive. And we were, and so I've sort of built my. Luckily, it won a Best Documentary Award, and it gave me a good sort of work sample, shall we say.
You mentioned the stunt movies, and I went through your filmography a bit, and I saw you're all over. You have kids' movies, you have action movies, you have horror movies, you have a few comedies, you have what looks like a tear-jerking drama. That's the one. I see a little bit more the martial arts and the action. Is that your favorite? It just doing the stunts and that kind of thing, or do you just like if it's a great story, I just want to do it?
Well, initially, I was thinking Australia is unknown as a film producing country, and certainly in 1972. When I made The Stuntmen, and Australia was still broadcasting in black and white and didn't broadcast in color till 1975, because the manufacturers had to sell all their whole black and white sets first, you see. I had to think, well, how do I get my money back? Well, I make something that, let's say, caters to the universal currency of the international entertainment market. So action is the universal currency of movies and to a degree of television. Television is probably more the medium of close-up and dialogue and character. But television still needs action pictures, albeit made on their budget. So I made this documentary focusing on, you know, something that had studied and knew how to do, and was able to ultimately turn the 16 grand over, you know, and recoup, you know, about 40 grand total. So that was good proof of concept, and I was then able to expand my budget range a bit after that. But it was a question of identifying the market, because if you make a film for a small group of people, but you spend, you know, much more than they can return to you on it, then, you know, people are not going to invest in you if you lose them money. So you have to, you know, make something that people want to see. Now, people want to see all kinds of stories. But action was something that I knew something about, and was at that time, I had a lot of people wanting to do stunts and learning on the job to a degree. We all were learning on the job. And so it was easy initially to make stunt movies and martial arts movies. So I did The Stuntmen, I did The World of Kung Fu, another documentary, I did The Kung Fu Killers, and 75-minute television documentary, all traveling, you know, or dealing with the new Kung Fu movie industry in Hong Kong in the early 70s. And originally, I flew to Hong Kong to do an interview with Bruce Lee, but he died probably just as I was boarding the plane, and I found out I got there. So I made a tribute to him. But it enabled me to connect with a big Hong Kong company, Golden Harvest, and then form a co-production with them and my Australian company to make The Man from Hong Kong, which was a vigorous martial arts movie. And then there was Death Cheaters, which is another stunt movie, and there was Stunt Rock, which was another stunt and rock movie. But I was anxious to diversify, and so in due course, various things. Day of the Assassins was an attempt to do a Mexican-American-Spanish co-production of a spy drama with Chuck Connors and Glenn Ford. So that enabled me to broaden my range. And then after that, BMX Bandits. After that, Turkey Shoot, which was a high camp, politically incendiary, action horror splatter movie, which was considered to be kind of edgy for its day. In fact, in Britain, it was actually cited in a list of what in Parliament. At some point of concern about violence in the cinema, there was a list of video nasties, and Turkey Shoot was on that list, along with The Evil Dead, and a good company as far as I'm concerned.
I would say, yeah, if you're on the same list as Evil Dead, you've done something right.
Yeah, so that got me in the beginnings into horror. Though obviously with some of the stunt work, I'd explored horror. Hospitals Don't Burn Down, the 25-minute documentary, dramatized documentary of what happens when a multi-story hospital catches fire, and we just reenacted it. Actually, the crew and I called it The Towering Infirmary, but Hospitals Don't Burn Down you can find on YouTube, and some people call it sort of an industrial safety horror film. So we did fry a few people in it, that's for sure. Frying a nerd girl, the laundry chute opens up and a great blast of flame comes out. That took people a little bit by surprise, but effective, and was used as safety film in Australia. Everyone who joined an Australian hospital, joined the staff, had to see it as part of their induction. Anyway, so from that, it was easy to... once you've done more than one single genre, oh, he can do that too. Oh, well, maybe he could do this. So I was able to diversify into war, Sahara, the Siege of Firebase Gloria, yeah. Britannic, the sad story of Titanic's sister ship, and thrillers, Escape Clause, and its indictment of the insurance industry with Andrew McCarthy and Paul Sorvino, and so on. And then pure docudrama, political docudrama like DC 9/11 Time of Crisis. So I managed to run the gamut, and with the Leprechaun movies, perhaps I was able to push the envelope even further in that genre with Leprechaun in Vegas, number 3, and Leprechaun in Space, number 4. So I assume you have seen those.
I have. It's been a while because I think the last ones came out in the 90s. I think you had Leprechaun, which was the first one. I think came out in the late 80s, and it had. And I apologize. I think we're having some bandwidth issues here, so your video is bouncing around here so far for our watchers here, but we can hear you just fine. So that's the important thing.
Okay.
The The second, I know I've watched them all at one point or another. I remember when Leprechaun went to the Hood, and I don't know if that was after year two. I think it was after the two you did.
That was after.
Yeah, that I knew that they didn't care anymore. And I don't know, there's something kind of fun about that.
Well, I didn't think in the first place, but I wasn't actually a big fan of the franchise but prior to being asked to do number three. Number three was meant to close the franchise. Number two had not done as well as number one. I mean, they'd spent more on it than number one. So...
Yeah, that happens.
I think number two was supposed to be Bride of Leprechaun.
Oh, no. Did you, you said that what you like to do, and I don't have the exact quote in front of me, that you like to do things that are wacky, and you use the word wacky a lot in your, do you recall that specific quote?
Oh, yes, yes. So, wacky is my name, you know, along with subtle. I have anarchic sense of humor. I'm a bit of an iconoclast. I question, established thinking. So all my films have a kind of subversive streak, really starting from Mantra from Hong Kong. I mean, a white hero going to Asia, bedding a few lovelies, beating up tons of Chinese martial artists who obviously looked much more flexible than the white hero. And that would be the formula for, an adventure in the East for a hero. But I turned that upside down and had a Chinese Dirty Harry be sent to Australia on a routine expedition and come into contact with some rather racist cops. I decided to go out to big and embarrass them all and basically sort of wreck Sydney in the process, to be played by former James Bond George Lazenby. So there's a lot of racist humor by the cops, which is actually not intended. You're intended to laugh at it rather than with it, but it was intended to be a little social comment. So that's not normally what you put into a B-movie action picture, but I did. So that you'll find that I enjoy a genre homage and celebrate the sort of standard genre tropes of the past in a particular genre, but also to put a new, slightly subversive edge into it. I mean, the Leprechaun movies allowed me to stick it to Vegas, the capital of greed, and they didn't want us there at all. They didn't want us filming outside their casinos, let alone inside them. So we did the inside of the casino at the Ambassador Hotel in L.A. and one scene on Wilshire Boulevard that arguably was a Vegas street, but all the Vegas exteriors we stole without permits between, let's say, 6 p.m. one night and 6 a.m. the next morning. We brought Warwick in full, and then we made him up and took him down to the Fremont District and then started basically bicycling him, well, wheeling him around, let's say, to get great backgrounds. I mean, the Golden Nugget turned us down. No, you can't shoot outside us. But we just snuck up, and I put the 14mm lens on the pavement and made it look like the Leprechaun was towering over the front of the Golden Nugget, which can be the effect of the 14mm lens if correctly placed. And then Warwick said, "Oh, Golden Nugget, I'd like one of those." So we were able to graft a whole bunch of sort of iconic Vegas sights into the film. And of course, people started following us around saying, "Are you making a Leprechaun movie?" "Yes, well, can we be in it?" I said, "Oh, good, because I can't afford extras." So look, what would you like, come walking down the street and the leprechaun is walking the other way and you don't even notice him. And he's muttering to himself and so on. So we were able to get a little bit of crowd action. And people came and participated in about three different shots once they realized what we were doing, because they wanted to be in a leprechaun movie, which, hey, I wear that as a badge of pride.
I would. I mean, if I could get, I'm just happy to get, my editing halfway decent, and I can probably listen to you for 10 hours just telling me about how lenses work, because all of this is it's one of those things. Like, I ended up in working in IT, but I always loved movies. I wish I would have gone down that road, but you make your bed. And now I'm kind of doing this just for the enjoyment of it all more than anything. Cool. And I make these little, analysis of different films and things, and try to put humor in it and have fun with it. So, when I hear this kind of stuff, it's just catnip. I just love listening to it. One thing I was curious about, a notorious story in fandom is the Fantastic Four movie from 1994, which was made for no other reason than to keep the rights. And it's kind of a famous story that finally got out, but it was never meant to be released. It was just there to keep the rights. I saw that you did a Porky sequel called Pimpin' Pee-wee. Did you?
Pimpin' Pee-wee. It was.
Yeah.
It initially, I think they tried to float it as Porky's The College Years, and make it contemporary as opposed to the 50s, as the original Porky's was.
Right.
There were certain sort of disputes and legal problems that I had nothing to do with and no real understanding of that were going on behind the scenes and subsequent to the film being shot. And it was ended up being released as Pimpin' Pee-wee on pay-per-view. But it was a situation where there was an obligation to make a movie of some sort of movie of Porky's before the rights the company's rights expired, and if they had made a movie, then they could go on. They would retain the rights, and they could make certain. They could make follow-up sequels to that. And I think they decided, well, let's make the cheapest possible version we can, throw it onto pay-per-view, maybe trade on the Porky's name, which ultimately they weren't able to do for whatever reason, so it got very minimal release. I did cover shots for some of the scenes where there was nudity, strippers in the strip club, for instance. So I would do a bras on version of the shot and then a bras off version of the shot. And the bras off obviously was for the film itself. But if it ever played on the Comedy Channel or something like that, you can put these cover shots in and you don't have to cut those shots out. And so that's the whole area of cover shots in film and television is a whole interesting area that, from about 1990 onwards, when I started working in America, particularly in American television, there had to be cover shots. If you made something for direct-to-video, but you knew it would eventually play on television, you had to make sure that all the swear words were covered, and any nudity or extreme violence was covered in a way that it didn't get cut out, but it was had let's say softer coverage.
So bras on. Now we gotta do bras off. Work, right?
Oh yeah, it was fun. Okay, said. Action, they do their thing, cut, that was good, okay, bras off, bras on, it was like one of the, I've had many interesting commands as a director, and that was certainly one of them. I think One of my favorites is Camera 3, Look for Sharks. It was the only live television broadcast that I've ever directed, which was in 1970. Before Australia went to colour, they had and they were gearing up for colour. Their colour, at that stage, they had an outside broadcast unit, which was an Avis rented truck with the equipment in it and two folding chairs. And they could plug that in or have a satellite link to a TV facility, and they could, we could cue in pre-edited film sequences when we needed to. But this is a live television broadcast in French, beamed to France from 8:45 a.m. Christmas morning, which was 11:45 p.m. Christmas Eve French time, so that at 9 a.m. Australian time, at midnight Christmas Day, therefore dawning in France, Father Christmas could be seen on the prow of the Manly life-saving Manly lifesavers. But there's a suburb called Manly, and there were very Manly people in it, and a lot of Manly people joined the lifesaving club, and they patrol the beaches and fish out people who are drowning. Anyway, they're a big Australian tradition. So Father Christmas was mounted on the prow of this big rowing boat and rowed to shore, so that 100 kids from an orphanage could mob him around a planted Christmas tree, and he could give them Christmas presents. This was to show French audiences how Australians celebrate Christmas. And it was all done live, we'd got all these film sequences ready, and then we had a French host who was talking in French. I had moderate French understanding, not only moderate. And the French producer, who came down with the host, that was the only two came from France, he had no English. So he was beside me in the Avis rented truck, just as Father Christmas was being rowed ashore, very nervous Father Christmas, as I recall. And the French host was saying, Australia is surrounded by shark-infested waters. And he was saying this in French, and then his producer suddenly picked up on this and said, les raquins. And I hadn't picked raquin out of the hosts. I was too busy sort of doing other things but I knew the word raquin, and that meant shark. Oh God. And so the producer was waving his finger, and I suddenly got it. Oh God, maybe they think there's a shark there and it could eat Father Christmas. So Camera 3, look for sharks. So the camera was panning frantically from side to side along the waves to see if there were any fins. It was a glorious moment of absurdist comedy, let's say, in the director's, outside broadcast van. So I listed as one of my favorite directions that I've ever given to crew. Camera 3, look for sharks.
So let me ask you, I'm going to ask you for two favorite movies. And if they're the same one, that's fine. The first one is your favorite end result. Like the movie, just watching the movie, you like it so much you even like to watch it. And the other one would be the favorite movie that you worked on, that you had the most fun, the most interesting, the best time on. Those two.
Well, I'll do the second one first. So it's really hard to pick the one favorite. There are a number that obviously spring to mind. I believe in having fun making a movie. I don't necessarily, for some, it has been a very anxious experience always. I know George Lucas hated directing. He tried to reduce directing to its simplest possible terms with all digital sets and so forth. If the actors do their thing and he records it. But one of the co one of those who worked on the original Star Wars, John Steers. He was in the visual effect, he helped build R2-D2 and things like that. He used to blow up, things on Bond movies. John Steers, great guy, dead now. But he said, George hated directing. He really didn't like it. He didn't like people constantly asking him questions about motivation and things like that. So some people, directing is an anxious, experience. You think, what if I'm making a mistake, have I put the camera in the right place? Or, the actor asks, why am I doing this scene? Or why am I saying this line? And you're being bombarded with questions all the time. I actually quite like that, but some people don't. But therefore, I have fun. I believe, humor is it's important to give instructions with humor and make everyone feel included and that they're all part of something. And I try to project my enthusiasm for the project and why this film is fun, why this scene is going to be fun, because this and this is going to happen, and that's a great angle, and look at the light there, et cetera, et cetera. So, based upon my approach to the work, I would say my favorite films, I would say The Man from Hong Kong was a little anxiety inducing because it was a co-production and my very first film with people who wanted to second guess me. But I would have to say that Hospitals Don't Burn Down, just a 25 minute short, which we did over 18 nights, 10 hour, 12 hour days of nights to produce 25 minutes. So it was quite difficult and elaborate to make, but there was such an esprit de corps, such a feeling we're doing something important here. We're making a fire safety film that, we're making it like a drama and like a horror movie. So the buzz you get, under those circumstances, when everyone is also feeling the same way, is great. And I would say BMX Bandits, Frog Dreaming, Sahara, which was my Desert War movie, and Night of the Demons 2, which preceded the two Leprechaun movies. I did the all three movies with the same producers, Jeff Joffre and Walter Joston. And got on very well with them, and they got me, and they encouraged me and didn't hold me back, so that was a joyous experience, even making making Happy Face Murders in Toronto with Anne Margaret and Marg Helgenberg of CSI fame, that was a joyous experience. So I would list those as favorites of mine in terms of the working experience. And I think all those movies turned out well as a result of having, a unified and joyous experience in the manufacture of the product. But your first question was really...
the product itself. Which one do you think... Maybe most proud of, or one that you think was that came out. You say, you know what? That's a really good movie,
but not one of mine.
No, one of yours.
One of mine. Well, that you can choose really from those of the above. But Sahara, to be shot in 18 10-hour days, when the original was shot in 25 days. And the original had Humphrey Bogart. We had James Belushi, who was great. I got on well with him. Some people can't stand him, but he's a good guy and a good actor. And he felt that the quality of the Australian cast that I put alongside him helped him lift his game. And he said so to me many times and in writing. And so that was an intense period where, in effect, you were going to war and making a war movie. It was kind of different from making a war movie like Siege of Fire Base Gloria, where we were making it in a war zone. where the helicopters were late one day because they were strafing and bombing real people 100 miles north. Ooh. And that was less of a joyous experience in that regard. But Sahara was great. Get up at 5, hit the breakfast table in the dark at 6, wait for to get color temperature by 6:45 to 7, already start preparing the first shot in the dark until you actually had enough light. And of course, we did have some good dawn shots, and then work like hell for the next 10 hours before you lose the light. Then go back to the hotel, eat something, look at the rushes, and then between 8 and 9:30 maybe, meet in the producers, either the producers' hotel room or Jim Belushi's hotel room, depending upon what was with all the cast for the next day's shoot. Run through the scenes together, have a little rehearsal, get everyone's questions out so that they know what they're doing and why they're doing it before the shoot the next morning, and go to bed and having internalized that subconsciously. So off to bed up at 5 the next morning, and 6 day weeks, and it was a campaign. And so I would probably have to, and I got bronchitis in the last four days. So I was, I was getting sicker, but feeling like I was really making a good movie. It was a very well-reviewed movie, premiered on Showtime as their World War II anniversary movie in 1995. And that's one that that was a joyous experience that I would treasure.
Well, I definitely have to check it out. I gotta tell you, it's been, if nothing else, it's been a joy that I rediscovered something that I had long forgotten. And as I'm watching it going, I remember that and enjoying it a lot more, because you always worry about going back to something that you loved as a kid, and then you get older like everybody does. You go back, you go, ooh, that wasn't so good. And it turned out to be better than I remember. Not that I remembered it that much, because it was 35 years ago that I saw it. But I want to thank you for that, because it's like, hey, I just rediscovered something, and that's always fun to do. So just you agreeing to do this interview gave me that. So, well, you've been great. I really do appreciate it. We've been going on for 45 minutes now, and you're
for punishment. Anyway,
that's right. Let me get that in the big screen. B Movie Trade is the book, The Adventures of the B Movie Trade, and it's available on Amazon. It's a big, thick, 500 page monstrosity, so that if you after you get done reading it, you can use it as a special effect later on in your movie to kill the bad guy. And I'll tell you what, I do agree that making something fun and enjoying your work is going to result in a better product, and I think that there's no coincidence in that. So words of wisdom from you here and to our readers. So excellent. Thank you very much, Brian. I do appreciate it.
I thank you for asking me, and I think you will get some chuckles out of the book when you read it.
I will definitely take a look at it, and we'll try to give it a little a review on the website. The website, of course, is right down there, guys, lastmovieoutpost.com, and you can hit us on all the major platforms. I want to say thank you again to our guest, Brian Trenchard Smith, and he's been a good sport here today for me.
No problem. I love movies, and I love people who love movies. And thank you for your enthusiasm. Movies make the world go round, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I'll tell you what, the fact that I'm looking through this am realizing that there's this whole plethora. Now, maybe part of that is because a lot of your stuff maybe didn't get to the States with streaming now. I don't think that's a problem. But I feel like I have missed out on a very large catalog of movies here by you, and makes me hang my head in shame as a movie buff a bit. So
well, some are better than others. the ones that I've mentioned, I think, are definitely worth a visit. You've got 41 to choose from. So
well, it is a pandemic.
Thank you very much.
Got time, so I can do it. So take care, and take care all you outposters, and we'll see you on the next stream.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.